Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Without a doubt, one of the most important and influential voices in the social justice movement following Michael Brown's death in Ferguson is that of Brittany Packnett. She's an educator, was a member of the Ferguson Commission, also served on President Obama's Task Force on 21st Century Policing. She's leaving her post here as Executive Director for Teach for America St. Louis to take a national role with that organization as Vice President of National Community Alliances. Brittany Packnett joins me in studio. Brittany, nice to have you back with us again.
Great to be back. Thank you.
Well, congratulations on the new position as you climb the ladder.
You know, I see it less as climbing the ladder than and more as continuing to do work that I feel incredibly fortunate to do. The last 2 years have taught me so much about how we listen and learn from people, how we truly adapt to meet the needs of students, families, and communities, with their vision being at the forefront. And so that's what this role is really about. And I'm excited to take what we've been doing in St. Louis and start to help spread it across the country.
What exactly will you be doing? How will it work?
So the job is essentially twofold. One is, and what's very exciting, is that our team will be responsible for setting a civil rights agenda for our organization. And I choose those words very carefully because this really is about the rights of our young people, right? This is about their right to an excellent and equal education, regardless of their background or their zip code. And so what we want to do, quite honestly, is go on a bit of a listening tour and hear from parents and students and veteran educators and people who've come to education through many different pathways to find out how we can be a true partner to communities and make sure that we're being responsive to what the needs are. The other half of it is actually managing five of our initiatives dedicated to communities of color. They've been in existence for a number of years. And so those teams that manage our relationships and ability to listen and learn from our African-American communities, Latino communities, Asian-American, Pacific Islander, Native communities, as well as the DACA core members that we bring in. We accept a number of Dreamers as teachers and assist them in their citizenship. And so our team will also be covering and managing that work.
That's, boy, talk about things that are going on in the world today. You're going to be touching all of those bases, aren't you?
Indeed, right? It's impossible to understand the roots of educational inequity and why we are in the situation we're in when it comes to education without talking very clearly about issues of race, about issues of class, about issues of privilege and oppression. And we've ignored that for far too long in too many of our education organizations. And Teach for America has been very serious about correcting course on that for a long time. And so this is more of that work.
Given what you're going to be doing and what you have been doing, how would you assess the impact of today's political environment on this work? I mean, there is a certain degree of hostility out there, as we know, in terms of law and order and being tough on crime. One of the candidates says that America is a crime scene, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. I have heard some of that rhetoric being used in the last few months, the last few hours, actually. But what is happening in this political climate is actually the uncovering of a lot of the emotions that people, and people of color in particular, have felt for a very long time. And so we've seen that over the last 2 years. We've seen that in this movement. We've seen that in multiple social issues, education included. And so it's high time that we stop ignoring why we are here and how we got here and why people are frustrated and actually get down to building solutions.
Nicole Hudson has been quoted as saying, she's a member of Ford through Ferguson, that it took decades for us to get where we are now, and it's going to take decades more to resolve all of this. Do you agree with that?
You know, I love and respect Nicole and think she is such an incredible leader. And I'm excited for the implementation work that she's leading when it comes to the Ferguson Commission. So it's not just another report that is no different in 50 years. But I would push back and say it actually has taken far longer, right? We're talking about centuries, really, that have gotten us to this point. You know, we've taken our teachers before to the Mary Meacham Freedom Crossing. And when you think about Missouri coming into the Union as a slave state, when you think about the stories of the Floating Freedom School and people subverting laws that disallowed black people, black children to learn how to read and write and actually put them on a boat in between a slave state and a free state to make sure that they had access to a good education. All of those kinds of issues and fights were happening hundreds of years ago. And so it will certainly take a long time for us to see the kind of full change that we want to see. But there's a real commitment and sense of urgency that I've seen all across the community. So I remain hopeful.
You know, I'm thinking of a newspaper article I read recently. And given the work that you've done post-Ferguson, if you will, the question was raised, has Ferguson promoted change or promoted division?
You know, I've also heard several people share a version of the following phrase, right? That police violence is not new, but the cameras are, right? And so I would argue that the proverbial magnifying glass we have up to our country now may be a bit more new, it may be a bit more nuanced, it may be more visible to more people, but that the issues, the oppression, the frustrations that our communities and marginalized communities have dealt with for centuries, for decades in St. Louis are not new, right? And so shining a light on inequity is not the same as creating inequity, right? And we have to recognize that the longer we ignore where divisions already exist, the longer it's going to take for us to heal them, the longer it's going to take for people to see true equity, the longer it's going to take for people to see the kind of liberation that they deserve.
Yeah. While we're on the subject of cameras, you have one because you have a phone, and you were active with that yesterday. Tell us what happened, what you photographed, and what she's getting a lot of attention, not only on Twitter, but also by the St. Louis Police Department.
Yeah, you know, I had a full day of work. My office is on Washington Avenue. It's in one of the few black-owned buildings in the area, which is something we're really proud of, and I was taking some meetings out of a nearby coffee shop that is owned by folks who are, you know, great partners of the community, and was exiting the coffee shop in order to go to another meeting. And as soon as I sat in my car and started to close the door, I heard a police car with sirens on come up and kind of slam on the brakes about a car behind me into an alleyway that's essentially an entry and exit for a parking lot that's in between two restaurants, including the coffee shop I was in. And, you know, quite frankly, it's reflex at this point to begin to film what's happening. I think the cases of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile show us that it is necessary for us to hold our public officials accountable, and modern technology allows us to do that in new ways. So I immediately turned on my cell phone, started videotaping, and didn't end recording until the incident was mostly over. So I didn't see the incident itself. I basically witnessed the aftermath, an African-American man being arrested, not at all resisting arrest, but he kept saying that a white gentleman, a white man in a green shirt, had slapped him and that he had almost hit him with his car, and he kept yelling this, and I come to find out from two eyewitnesses that you can see on video, I come to find out that the white man in the green shirt was actually an off-duty police officer. What's significant is a couple of things. One, both of his friends, their story never changes. I ask them for their story multiple times, separately and together. Their story never changes, and their stories are exactly the same, that this off-duty officer hit the man first, pulled his weapon when he tried to defend himself, and that the friends tried to calm it down. One of the young men said to me, you know, I saw that gun and I had flashbacks of when I've been shot. And I knew that if I reached out to defend my friend, that any of us could have died in that moment. So there were over a dozen officers, nearly 9 or 10 police cars in the area. It's not a very wide street. There's a lot of pedestrian traffic. And as I was filming, I was repeatedly told by two officers that it was not my right to be filming them, even though I know that to be true. And so I continued to do so and wanted to make sure that we began the process of public accountability. And so I put that out on Twitter as a citizen, right? Not as someone who is at all looking to do any of the kinds of things that one of the candidates claims about this movement and claims about peaceful protesters and activists like myself and many others, but simply to ensure that this incident would not be ignored and that we get answers.
Yeah. Well, the police department has put out a statement, and you're aware of that. An internal affairs investigation has been started. They say the suspect became aggressive. Suspect physically assaulted the officer. Suspect grabbed for the officer's gun, requested that he shoot him. The officer sustained several abrasions to his face. So that's what the police department. Have you talked to the police department?
Unintentionally, actually, on my way over here, the police called my unpublished cell phone. I'm still not sure how they got that number. They asked if I would like to give a verbal statement. I let them know that I would be giving a written statement, again, to ensure that things are clear for the record, and that I'd also be filing a complaint as well as taking some other actions. You know what I think is significant about that is that had you or I committed an assault against another citizen, by having two eyewitnesses there testify as to one of us being involved in that assault, we absolutely would not have been allowed to continue to stand around to talk to witnesses of the assault. We would have been in the back of a squad car. And one of the things that we talk about in an activist collective that I helped co-found called Campaign Zero is the kind of shadow justice system that police officers are able to engage in. We're not talking about a level of accountability that shouldn't happen for any of our for all of our public officials. We are simply talking about people being held accountable for their actions. So in the video, you can see this officer speak to one of the witnesses. You can see him continue to stand. He actually helps arrest the man who claims to have been assaulted by the same person. And so these are all issues that we need to continue to hold our public servants accountable on, and remind people, right, that the power of law enforcement, the power of all public servants is derived from the people.
What was the reason for arresting this? I know he hit him with the car or nudged him with the car. The man in question was walking on the road. Is that
he was walking across an alley from what the two witnesses told me. And that the officer almost hit him with his car.
I couldn't help but think of other people walking on the road and running into similar kinds of problems, Michael Brown being one of them. Mm-hmm. The most recent incident in Milwaukee also involved a person walking on the road, and that wound up in a shooting as well.
You know, and in these moments, people often accuse us of jumping to conclusions. The fact of the matter, though, is that if in so many of these cases, if we don't demand accountability and transparency on the front end, we never get it. What we know is that the vast majority of killings by police go unprosecuted and unconvicted. And so we want to ensure that justice actually works for our community when for so long it has not, right? And we want to make sure that equity is the call of the day, that liberation is the call of the day, and not just in policing, right, and things that are affected by systemic oppression and racism. So that includes education, housing, unemployment, mass incarceration. But most certainly, there needs to continue to be an investigation, but there needs to be clear transparency and public accountability, because the story that I heard from two separate eyewitnesses is very different than the statement that was put out today.
Well, at some point, you'll be talking to the police about this, and then we'll see where it goes from there. Mm-hmm. How satisfied are you, if that's the right word, with progress being made post-Ferguson?
I don't know if satisfied is the right word. I remain hopeful and urgent, right? I think those are probably the best ways to describe how I try to face every day, with a sense of urgency, the same sense of urgency that I learned in my own third grade classroom, right? Because my 8 and 9 year old students could never get that Tuesday back. They could never get that Wednesday back. And for all of the lessons that I learned and all of the mistakes that I made as a young teacher, every single day it was another chance to get up and get it right and to recognize that we don't have any time to waste. And so I bring that same sense of urgency with me everywhere, especially in this work. But I also remain hopeful. I mean, the amount of people who have continuously engaged with issues of justice, fairness, and equity, in multiple sectors, right, given their talent, given their skill sets, given their beliefs, has been really inspiring. And, you know, it's people that continue to give me hope every day. It's people who came to lots of Ferguson Commission meetings. It's people who've taken that report and saying, what is my individual or organizational responsibility to seeing this through? It's people who continue to peacefully protest in the streets and make sure that accountability and pressure is the name of the day. So there is work being done across every single part of this region, and the people who continue to wake up every morning with that same sense of urgency and commitment really do inspire me.
I want to pick up on that point. We have to take a break. I'm talking with Brittany Packnett. You know her well here for her work with Teach for America and the work with the Ferguson Commission. She's also worked for President Obama on a national task force. We'll come back and continue our conversation. Brittany is leaving her current post and is taking a larger national post, if you will, with Teach for America. Back to continue our conversation in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Brittany Packnett. Brittany, you raised the issue of work yet to be done. I wanted to talk to you about the generational component of that. It seems to me, and we've talked about it on this program before, you and I and others, that there is a generational component, that the young people today may be the key to what's all ever really working.
Absolutely. You know, I'm a student of history, studied African American studies at WashU here. And so much of why I do what I do is because people did it for me, right? People whose names I've only ever read in a history book but greatly admire, right? People like Septima Clark and Fannie Lou Hamer, and then people that I know well, right? Civil rights leaders right here in St. Louis, my own parents, people who've committed to this community. And so when we talk about the generational assets, they are all around us. And yet I'm also always reminded that folks – usually get their start when they're really young. A lot of people got into the work of justice in whatever capacity as teenagers, as college students, and there is a level of energy, of imagination, of creativity that young people have really poured into this movement, as well as their sacrifice. There were so many students that I know who would be out in the streets in Ferguson standing up for their rights till 1 or 2 in the morning, wake up, go to school, do their homework, get good grades, go to work, take care of their family members, and do it all over again. And that's the kind of energy and optimism and engagement that we've seen here in Ferguson. That's the kind of leadership that we've seen across St. Louis, and I'm excited by it.
You know, one of the things that I have observed in recent years prior to the Ferguson incident was that young blacks and young whites were getting along quite nicely, thank you, going out in groups and interacting with each other, more so than I can ever remember. And yet, I see this not so much recently.
Well, and you know, I think it's because we often have to face the difference in our realities, right? And that's not to say that bridges and relationships can't be built. It is to say, though, that we don't always live in the same America. And so sometimes when we are forced to have these kinds of conversations with our friends, they can bring us closer. They can develop a different level of awareness, but they can also be very challenging. And so my hope is that as people have engaged people that they're in relationship with, friends, loved ones, partners, spouses, that there is a level of accountability and evolution, right? That people really are learning more about their neighbors, more than just whether or not they like the chocolate chip cookies that they brought over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What have you been seeing in your role with Teach for America?
You know, I've been seeing that the ways in which young people have led, especially over the last 2 years, deeply influenced us in the right ways. We heard very clearly from our students and their families, it's not okay to just care about what happens to us in the classroom. You have to care about who we are, about where we come from, about the rich cultures that we come into our classrooms with, and about the challenges that we face as soon as we step out of the school building. And so we deeply invested at Teach for America St. Louis in a teaching practice or pedagogy called culturally responsive teaching. And what it does is it aligns academic rigor, cultural consciousness, and cultural confidence all alongside one another in the classroom. So that if you're a first-generation student, if you're a student of color, if you're a white student, if you're coming from a low-income background, that we recognize the value that you bring into the classroom. We know that everything you need to be powerful is already in you, and it's simply our job to help you construct meaning of the world and give you access and opportunity to flex your muscles and learn the right skills. And so taking that orientation has been really successful for us. Our teachers have continued to see incredible growth. Our teachers on average make more than a year's worth of growth inside of one single school year. And when I look at an alumni-led school actually not too far from here, Patrick Henry Elementary, their sixth graders made an average 2 years of growth this year. They've got Teach for America teachers, veteran educators. It's led by an alum of Teach for America. And that's the kind of engagement and turnaround and confidence that we really want to see in our young people so that they're not just great learners when they leave the classroom, but they're also exceptional leaders.
In your new role with Teach for America, you start in October, I believe. Mm-hmm. Will you be as active, or can you be as active in your activism as you have been?
You know, that activism happens in my personal time, right? And so what it means ultimately is that I sleep less. I will continue to do those things that are movement work and movement time and continue to do those things that are my full-time work in that time. But, you know, it would be disingenuous to suggest that they're completely separate, right? The same young people who are out here on the streets are the same ones in our classrooms, the same young people wondering if this is a world that will love them for who they are and allow them to be unapologetically who they are, the same ones searching for that power in our classrooms. And so I believe it's our responsibility in education, and quite frankly, for any of us who work on social issues, to learn from this moment and to learn from this movement and to listen to the voices of the most affected and have our actions be influenced by that.
You know, you became something of a household word following the Michael Brown shooting.
A lot
of people got to know Brittany Patnett, sure, who may not have known of you before. And I've been wondering what got you rolling in all of this, whether it was the actual shooting of Michael Brown, the demonstrations that followed immediately, or was it just kind of an eruption of a frustration that maybe you've had for a long time?
You know, it was, I think, a reminder to be present and to be proximal and to assume the risk. You know, the first protest that I went to, I couldn't even walk, right? I was really raised in a tradition of social justice, and not just to talk about it, right, but to walk that walk and to do it in practice. And that is why I chose the work of education. When I became a teacher, when I did policy work and advocacy work in Washington, D.C., it was because I wanted to take the voices of my community, of my classroom, you know, Dante and James and Shantae and Queen, I wanted to take all of them with me as people made decisions that would continuously affect our lives, right? And to help be one of the voices in a growing and mightier chorus of folks working to ensure that the decisions we make are right for everyone. And so, you know, I've always been committed to justice work, but there was something about Michael Brown's body being valued so little that he was allowed to just lay out in the street for 4.5 hours, that children in that community were valued so little that they had to walk past that scene and ingest that trauma, that Michael had graduated from a school where we placed teachers. And I've said before, and I'll say again, that his diploma wasn't bulletproof. So there's more to care about than just what happens in the classroom. And I was with actually a number of high school age girls in Kansas City giving a speech on August 9th. And I came home earlier than planned on August 10th because I realized I had told these young women that we needed them to be leaders one day. When the reality was, when I looked on Twitter, it was young people their age that were out there demanding justice. And I realized that I had a responsibility to help create leaders for today, to help empower leaders for today. So that moment was really transformative for me to remind me that it's one thing to do this from 9 to 5. It's another thing to do this with your whole life and to sacrifice your body. And there's so many people who've sacrificed so much for this movement.
How effective has Black Lives Matter been, do you think, in all of this, both immediately after and since? I know, and I'll just make this observation, it's angered a lot of people. A lot of white people are angered by this movement.
you know, I come for the last 2 years, I think the most well-worn pages in my library are the pages of Dr. King's letter from a Birmingham jail. And he talks about this so frequently, right? He talks about the white clergy who you would think would want to create a world of equity and justice, but who were telling him, slow down, stop protesting, stop with the demonstrations because it's angering people, because it's frustrating people and getting in people's way. And what he pushed back on was this idea that calling attention to injustice is in and of itself injustice. Justice, right? What he actually said to them was that, you know, A, I need to be wherever injustice is, and we all should be committed to those places where injustice exists to correct those things, but also that pressure creates the necessary conditions for change. Protest creates the necessary conditions for change. And so this isn't actually about preserving our comfort. Preserving our comfort is what got us here. Preserving the status quo is what got us here. Disrupting the status quo and replacing it with an equitable reality for people, a liberatory reality for people, is what will actually move us forward. So we'll get over our emotions. We'll have to on the pathway to something better.
You know, I think when presidential candidate Donald Trump spoke last night outside of Milwaukee, he spoke to his audience, needless to say. But he was also speaking about the need for equity amongst African Americans and the need for respect for the police department. I know you watched at least part of that speech.
I watched part of it. I don't know that I would define equity in that way, right? When we talk about equity, we're not talking about everyone getting the same thing. We are talking about people getting what they need in order to have access to equal outcomes. And then when we move even further past that and we talk about liberation, we talk about the barriers being removed such that people actually don't need highly adaptive services. They already have perfect access to everything that they need to be successful, to have full choice in their life, and to not be treated differently by the systems in this country. And, you know, when we talk about policing, it's the same way that we have to talk about all of those other issues I've mentioned: education, housing, incarceration, healthcare. We're not talking about individuals here. We're talking about entire systems that often were never built with people of color in mind in the first place, or were built in particular to subjugate people of color, right? To siphon us off and to treat us differently intentionally. And so correcting those systems will take a long time. And it means that we have to be honest about what's happening to African-American, Latino, people of color in this country. We have to be honest about how systems are treating us disproportionately unfairly. And we have to be honest about what real solutions are and not just give in to rhetoric that seems to make people excited.
Well, I mentioned Donald Trump because what he said last night, some people thought was a little inconsistent with some of the things that he'd been saying prior to last night.
Yeah, you know,
you don't want to talk politics.
That's not the issue. I worry about rhetoric in general, right? Mm-hmm. I am focused on plans. I'm focused on solutions. And that's for anyone running for any office, right? It is one thing to get a crowd really excited. It's one thing to play to your crowd in one state and play totally differently to a crowd in another state, which may be what you're getting at. But it is another thing to be accountable to the people that require you to have substantive plans for our betterment. And that's the only thing I actually want to focus on. It's quite frankly why I stopped watching the speech, right? Because for a number of reasons, but ultimately rhetoric won't save us. Action will.
Yeah. Another thing I wanted to talk to you about, because I think the entire country and the world has been impressed with the performance at the Olympics by young Simone Biles. And also Simone Emanuel, another two Simones, which I found a little bit unusual. It occurred to me in watching that, what sort of an impact do two young women like this, who have obviously worked very hard to achieve what they've achieved, what impact do you think that has on other young people in America, particularly young African-American women?
You know, I tweeted this actually because I woke up after both of their medals, and, you know, Simone Biles has won multiple at this point, multiple golds. But I woke up after both of their medals, and all I could think about were I said my mood was Black Simone. And I thought about Simone Biles and Simone Emanuel and Nina Simone, right? And this this stance of power that for so long Black women have been taught to be ashamed of. We've been taught to be ashamed of being powerful, of being opinionated, of having great talent and great depth, and greatness to offer the world, right? That has been erased in so many ways for hundreds of years. And so fighting to keep that and to be proud of that is something, quite frankly, that has also been a part of this movement, right? To be unapologetic about who we are. And so I think that their examples are not only important for young women to get into these particular sports, but also about helping us remember to seize our power no matter what.
We only have a minute left, but, you know, there have been many successful African-American athletes at the Olympics. But these two in particular, and particularly Simone Biles, coming at this time, mm-hmm. I think is very important.
Oh, the
time absolutely. We've been talking about.
Absolutely. You know, we are in a time of everything from Beyonce's formation to Jesse Williams' speech at the BET Awards to a movement that is committed to equity and liberation for people of color. And so to be in the midst of that in this moment and to remind us that we have everything inside of us that we need to be the powerful, incredible people that we were ever meant to be, that's a very special thing. It's incredible to witness.
We're going to have to say goodbye, but we have an email here from Dick Fleming, whom you know from,
yes.
I'm sure. He wishes you well, knew your mom and dad, and just
thank you very much.
Has a great deal of respect for you and your family. So he wishes you well,
thank
as
you.
We do, Brittany Peck.
St. Louis has been so incredible to me,
well,
and I hope I've given a little something back.
Oh, you certainly have. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.